This is News in No Time at Gordon. On today's roundtable, Mexico's president takes to America's airwaves to convince African Americans he isn't racist. An American hero's parents lash out, and a vote would end filibusters. That, of course, is drawing near. And controversial photos of Saddam Hussein. Joining us from our Chicago bureau, Laura Washington, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. From Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Nat Irvin joins us. He is a columnist with the Winston-Salem Journal. And from Maryland, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. All right, first let's get to Mexican President Vicente Fox. We talked about his comments last week. He went on, after meeting with Jesse Jackson last week in Mexico City, he went on Reverend Jackson's syndicated radio program this past Sunday. Reverend Jackson was looking for an apology. Angie, can we get ready to play this clip? This is as close as it got.
And I very much regret the misinterpretation of a phrase I used in the framework of a speech related to immigration issues.
That is as close to an apology as Reverend Jackson got. George Curry, a number of things were talked about during that interview, and Vicente Fox also suggested that he didn't necessarily feel the need to say, "I'm sorry," because he believes his government, and he has proven throughout his career that he has a high commitment to human rights and says that he's eager to work with minority groups in the United States to improve labor conditions and the like. Was this enough? I know last week you didn't even feel the need for him to apologize.
Well, I don't know about saying I didn't feel that there was a need for an apology. It just, to me, it's not the most pressing issue in the black community. I'm sorry. Jesse running to Mexico and Al Sharpton running to Mexico. I mean, that's some place they can run right here in this country and be more useful. I mean, I just don't think you can show up, you know, wherever there's a camera, you be there. So I think he explained himself. The fact that he decided he's not going to specifically apologize for it and he pointed to his own record, I mean, that's sufficient for me.
I'm with George on this, Ed. I mean, this is manufactured outrage. I mean, clearly, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton don't have enough to do. I mean, now they're moving to the international arena to try to improve our relationships with Mexico. Yeah, this is a great strategy, all right. It seems to me that if there's anything to come out of this, it should be a recognition that, especially with the recent election of the Latino mayor in Los Angeles, and more black people should start learning Spanish. That's the thing that I'd be thinking about. And the other thing is, if this is some sort of strategy on the part of Jackson and Sharpton in terms of being Democratic operatives, it's a bad strategy. It will not work. The Republicans are going to win if they create this kind of us against them, us against the Latinos. It's a bad strategy. I mean, it's manufactured outrage.
Well, I wrote us against them, though. I don't agree with that. Nat. I don't think he's trying. In fact, Jesse says he's going to start a new organization. Between blacks and Hispanics. We need to get the ones we got functioning.
Well, George, that's absolutely on point. Rainbow Push, Jackson's organization, is supposed to be rainbow-oriented, diversity-oriented, but we know from that was really a creation that came out of his efforts to run for president 10 or 15 years ago, and his efforts to appear and have his organization appear to be not a black-based organization, which is essentially what it is. And this, again, is another attempt to do that. He had a press conference with the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund last week to announce this new organization that is going to be a coalition that is going to work toward immigration issues, toward bringing blacks and Latinos together. I wrote in my column about this today that Fox knew exactly what he was doing. He's crazy like a fox. He knew exactly what he was doing when he made this statement, when he said even blacks. And note that he said blacks, not African Americans, because he knows that race-based, color-based bigotry appeals to a lot of folks in Mexico and in the United States. We do have a color problem in this country.
So you believe this was calculated?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know. I don't know that he sat down and decided he was going to say this to this group, but he's probably said this many times, and this was the first time it really got picked up publicly. And it's something that he believes. It's something that he knows a lot of other folks out there believe, and he knows he can curry favor, especially with his own constituencies, by saying this.
I think that he was trying to make a point, and he was imprecise and used one word that was wrong. I mean, basically, he was saying that in your low-rung jobs that used to be held by African-Americans, Mexican-Americans are taking those jobs now. I think that was his point. I think he made a big mistake by inserting one word, and that one word was even.
So you believe, George, forgive me that for a moment, you believe that he's suggesting that, in fact, these jobs are not taken by African-Americans even more, as opposed to even the lowly African-American won't take this job.
Yeah, I don't just read something sinister into what he said, because the reality is, and let's just be truthful about it, there are some jobs some Mexicans have today that we used to have that we look down on today. And we really do not. And that's not to say that African Americans are not in these low-paying jobs, because we are in a lot of them.
Right.
But there are some jobs, and you look at the yards and certain construction industries, you can go across the board.
Right.
And in a way, to some extent, it means that African Americans have progressed by going up one ladder, one step on a ladder. But when in reality, when you look at the very, very bottom jobs, a lot of these jobs are held by Mexicans. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that there is some truth to the fact that we may look down on some of those jobs, but we also know that those jobs, that those opportunities are not attainable to us. We don't even bother to pursue them. And the reason they're not attainable to us is because the employers know that they can more readily exploit immigrants, especially Mexican immigrants, in those jobs. They can pay them less. They can make them work longer hours, and they don't have to worry about complaints or criticism, because these folks are immigrants. They're here. Many of them are here illegally, and they're desperate to get any of these jobs. That's why I think that's one of the issues that I think is important to come out of this discussion.
Now,
the immigrants are being exploited.
Let me take you back quickly to the idea of what was suggested early on in this conversation, and that is that Reverend Jackson and Reverend Sharpton may be misguided in spending so much time on this issue when perhaps more pressing issues should be looked upon. Do you believe that, for instance, Sharpton's trip today is a waste of time, since the president has already addressed this issue?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't dare. Well, maybe I would. I don't know if I'd say it's a waste of time. Maybe he has another agenda of which I am not familiar with. But in terms of the mass of the black people, the challenges that we're faced with, how could it possibly make sense that it is going to be important to me that the nuance of President Vicente Fox, the statement, the translation between what he meant, what he intended to say, you know, the cultural translation between that on this not even, or having not said not even. What if he didn't even say that? What if he just said lower income? I mean, how could that possibly be as important as some of the challenges that we face here at home? I don't see it. Now, I may be wrong completely with that, but I just think this is a matter of getting the cameras. It's manufactured outrage. It will have no meaning whatsoever to the mass majority, to the vast majority of black people, and the strategies that people will adapt for themselves for how they will live into the future. It will mean nothing.
All right. There you go, Nat Ervin. Thank you very much. Let's move on to something in terms of indignation that is clearly true and heartfelt from a family of a fallen American soldier, a fallen NFL hero, if you will, Pat Tillman. So much was made of this man giving up a lucrative NFL career, joining the military, being killed in the war, and then later finding out he was killed by friendly fire. Now his family is lashing out, suggesting that the military investigation into the friendly fire death in Afghanistan last year was a sham, in their words, and that America's efforts to cover up the truth have made it harder for them to deal with the loss of their son. George Curry, the thought of what has occurred within this situation, his father, Pat Tillman's father, going as far to say that the American government has all but torn up their poster child for this war, meaning his son.
Well, the criticism went beyond that. They were saying that the soldiers on the ground deliberately, I mean, they knew right away that this was, quote, friendly fire. I don't know how friendly it was, but that's what they're saying, and that the Army manufactured this, and so as to say, this is a great issue of patriotism. This NFL player went on to fight for his country, went to Iraq and then Afghanistan, but the family felt they had been lied to the whole while, and they don't trust anything the government says. And I think that's obviously a lot of pain in the family over this whole point. You know, it's hard enough to understand that you're losing your son, but it's even worse when you lied to about it.
I just think it's sort of the most horrible kind of circumstances. I mean, first of all, you lose a child. But then you think about it in context of the military and the family. And I feel both for the military and especially for the family because, you know, we need heroes. When we're in a difficult time, a nation looks to heroes. And then there's the Army finding itself having a situation where a hero that they created turns out to be, I mean, the story that they created, sort of like the Jessica Lynch story, turns out to be fabricated. It's a very difficult circumstance. And then, you know, how can you deceive a family about how your child died? That is horrible. And now here we are faced with, and it has serious implications because no wonder the Army is not meeting its recruiting goals, because we're faced with a situation where young people are starting to say, wait a minute, there's something disingenuous about this whole Iraq situation. I know for a fact, myself, thinking about young people, I just attended baccalaureate service last night, and, you know, you find out where kids are going to be going to college, what they're going to be doing after high school. And this one young man who had planned on going into the Army, he had been trained to be a Navy SEAL. He was training to be a Navy SEAL. But it turns out he's not going, and the reason is because this family is starting to look at this Iraq war and saying, wait a minute, something's not true about this situation. I know Tillman's situation was with Afghanistan, but we're right now in a difficult situation, not really trusting what our own Pentagon is telling us. I think it's a horrible circumstance.
Yet, Laura Washington, truth be told, and particularly with friendly fire incidents, this is not necessarily atypical, not just with this war and the building of heroes, taking poetic license, if you will, sometimes. The government has done this for years and years and years.
And we would not even be talking about this morning if it weren't for the fact that Tillman is a famous figure, and because the government had made such a hero out of him. This happens far too frequently. There is a lot of deception. Nat talked about this deception of bringing us to the war, in the war to begin with. We know because of the way the war is being conducted, because of the way the press is covering the war, embedded media that really don't have the freedom to report everything they see and hear. We know that there are a lot of lies that are being told. And again, when military personnel don't feel that they can trust their own government to tell them
right.
the truth, and especially when they're in the middle of a war,
right.
I think it not only does it erode confidence and interest in participating, but I think it also must create a tremendous amount of insecurity for the
right.
troops over there, and insecurity can be very dangerous in war.
Well, talking
Nat
about
mentioned Jessica Lynch, and that's another example. Here was a totally manufactured case, and what we see in this case, in the Jessica Lynch case, is that when they make up these stories, when they concoct these stories, they always backfire. So why even try it?
Right.
Talking about war and quagmire, we saw photos released of Saddam Hussein in his underwear. And it has incited in many places further anti-American violence in Iraq, further issues of how America is dealing with this. This, coupled with the Newsweek situation of the Quran desecration and many other things, has become far more problematic to the Bush administration than I think that they would like to admit and certainly want to deal with, Nat Irvin. When you look at these photos, what's your thought?
Well, it's the example, I think, Ed, of the kind of world we're living in, where ultimate example of transparency. You know, the same thing that happened with the Abu Ghraib prison photos. They came out, somebody took a digital photo, distributed, who knows where it came from, but suddenly here on the world stage is a picture of Saddam Hussein. On the one sense, it has no meaning. At least it has no particular meaning to me, but in the other sense, it gives you an indication of how within this new world we live in, one person has the power to be able to impact the image of the United States government. It shows you how, in some sense, how powerless we are in one instance, where on the one hand, we're full of shock and awe. We have these great weapons. But fundamentally, when it comes to how people perceive us, man, it looks like we're way behind. We don't quite yet understand how to manage this thing, and I'm afraid we're learning some tough lessons. On the one hand, you know, how could it have meant something, you know, to have a picture of of Saddam Hussein? Who could have ever conceived that we would have a picture of Saddam Hussein in his underwear just a few months ago? But here, now we have it. And it also raises the question of what else will we see in the future that we don't know about? It creates a certain amount of chaos that makes us all uncertain about how we're managing this affair in the Middle East.
I agree with the impact in that, but I don't agree that it makes us powerless. I think it makes us more powerful, that if one person can capture these kind of images, that's mean that they're less likely that they will be covered up, that the world
well,
will see it.
I agree with you. That's a transparency therapy.
See it as it is.
Yeah. I think one of the nuances here that might be overlooked is the fact that Saddam, the portrayals in these photos are not, they've got to be pretty humiliating for him, but and humiliating for Arab men in general, but he's not being tortured. He's not being mistreated in any evidence sense in these photographs, as opposed to the Abu Ghraib photos. And so there's a contrast here. You know, the guy that we went over there to get, the guy who's supposed to be the bad guy here, is you know, sitting around, you know, doing his laundry in his prison cell, while the folks many of whom are probably innocent of any crime, who we rounded up and kept down in Guantanamo, who we rounded up and kept at Abu Ghraib, are getting tortured or getting mistreated. There was just another story out in the New York Times last week about some cover-ups related to some torture of prisoners, and at least in one case, a prisoner who was probably innocent. So I think the contrast between Saddam, the bad guy, who's supposedly the bad guy, and his treatment is compared with other prisoners is really telling.
Yet there is a question with this, whether or not, in fact, the Geneva Convention has been violated and the like.
Yeah, the larger issue is that there was a breach of security here.
Right.
And the tabloids that published those photos said they paid money for them. The question is, here you got your number one prisoner. You can't get Osama bin missing. You can't find him. But your number one prisoner that you do have, that you can't keep it secure enough that you don't prevent photos being taken and put out on the market and sold. I mean, that says a lot about the security system that we have, and that raises serious questions.
I agree completely. And the other thing is, too, Laura, just to comment and make an observation about your point. I think the way that we perceive things is one thing. What's going on in Guantanamo Bay is one thing. But how the rest of the world perceives it seems to me to be the larger issue. That America doesn't seem to have its act together. That, you know, people say, on the one hand, we seem to be able to make, we can claim, or the United States government can blame Newsweek for its story, perhaps erroneous story about the use of the Quran. But on the other hand, we have to deal with the fact that we have a free press. And it seems to me that one of the difficulties that's happened over these last few months is all of this is muddled up. Yeah. You know, we're not able to distinguish between the role of the press and the role of the government. And so now here we are, have the military itself releasing prints to a tabloid.
Well, I tell you, it does seem to be graying in all of those areas and continues to be problematic. Laura Washington, Nat Irvin, George Curry, thank you very much for joining us on today's roundtable.